morning, everyone. I'm going to call this meeting to order. We have another busy day. It should be interesting. We have the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency with us to go over their outcomes from the as they stand currently, their proposed budget changes. Let's do the numbers. Oh, we get the commissioner. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Lenkstein. I'm the Commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning and lead off the agency's budget presentation, and a number of our staff will follow on. I have just a few slides to give a very broad overview of our agency and some of the important administrative details for what you'll hear in a more detailed presentation by the staff. Those of you who I haven't had the chance to meet before, I have worked for the state of Minnesota since 1978. Served at the Department of Natural Resources as a hydrologist and regulator in a variety of water programs in that agency for 25 years. I also did some work in trails and waterways. 6 years after my time at DNR, I worked at the Minnesota Department of Health and Environmental Health, Emergency Preparedness, Infectious Diseases, and the Public Health Laboratories. In the last 2 years, I've been at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I was brought in as the deputy commissioner with former Commissioner Paul Austin, and then last May, when Paul left for another opportunity, I was appointed by Governor Dayton to be commissioner. So it's my pleasure to represent an agency that I'm very proud of, that I think works hard on behalf of all Minnesotans to protect, maintain, and restore the environment for public health and for the health of our environment. My overview today of the slides, I'll quickly walk through our organization, some of our sort of the administrative oversight, and then our programs and our performance. And these are just sort of the main things that I'll be touching on. We do have budgeted for our agency 970 FTEs. We currently hold about 50 vacancies agency-wide, and that's in order to help absorb any potential shortfalls in state and federal funds. We have locations around the state. Our main office is here in St. Paul at 520 Lafayette Road, just north of the DNR building. We are also located in Brainerd, Detroit Lakes, Duluth, Mankato, Marshall, Rochester, and Wilmer. Our mission is to work with Minnesotans to protect, conserve, and improve our environment and enhance our quality of life. And as Governor Dayton said in his State of the State remarks last night, a healthy community, a healthy state, is built upon a foundation of clean air, safe water, and land that is sustainable. So this is our mission. We work with all people in the state to achieve it. In our strategic plan, which is you don't have a copy of, but it's on our website for those of you who want to see it. It's a very brief document. It's about 10 pages long. These are our strategic vision statements that we use to guide and measure our performance. And they're few, but I want to just quickly review them, that our agency is working on measurable and achievable objectives for environmental outcomes. We build on a foundation of science at the agency, and for those of you who haven't had the chance to work with our employees, they come from a variety of scientific backgrounds, including chemistry, biology, hydrology, soil science, and engineering, just to name a few. Our staff are all driven by work plans, and the work plans start with our strategic plan, which I mentioned is a short document setting broad direction. We then have a business plan that helps us shape our work for a two-year period. Our strategic plan is a five-year look. We're currently updating our strategic plan, and our business plan is about a two-year look, and then every one of our employees has an annual work plan that tracks from our strategies to our business objectives into their daily work. So we are focused on outcomes. We use over 150 performance measures that we review twice a year to check on our progress. And many of you have seen before, and I've carried around with me, I know Mr. Kadelka does too, our agency dashboard that looks like this, graphs of information about the environment and about our work that are just a snapshot of some of the measures that we use to gauge our performance. We look to evaluate ourselves and improve our operations. We want to be timely and we want to be efficient with our work. This started in 1998 with a process in the agency called Goal 21, which was an effort to reform the way the agency is organized. And just quickly before I leave this slide, these vision statements help us define whether we're making progress. So first of all, we know that we need clean and clear air. We need land that supports healthy ecosystems and sustainable land uses, water that supports a healthy aquatic ecosystem, healthy communities including people, and a strong economy. And then we also take actions to protect, meaning prevent things from happening. We know that the most effective use of time and other resources is to prevent damage from occurring in the first place. Just like our personal health, just like staying healthy as an individual, our state's land, air, and water resources are better when we prevent them from being harmed in the first place. And lastly, we demonstrate our excellence in operations, and this is why we measure our performance and how we try to track our work. We have seven divisions. What you won't see here is water permits. You won't see air permits. You won't see specific names of any individual program. This is because we have organized our agency in a matrix-based approach, and it is a flat, relatively flat organizational structure. We have 27 programs in our agency, and they operate across all these divisions. And that's largely driven by the reality that environmental problems are not solved by single discipline or single programmatic focuses. For example, we try to incorporate prevention as a strategy into every program we operate. So whether it's water, improving water quality, reducing air emissions, restoring land and protecting land, we incorporate prevention efforts into all of our programs. Similarly, small business assistance is a program that we use in across all programs, because if we can help business owners understand the regulatory system that we have in the state and manage to meet outcomes that are sustainable for our environment and for public health, oftentimes they can avoid the need for permits by simply designing their business operations differently. So we operate across all these divisions. We have, as I said, many, many different tools, including partnerships, assistance, enforcement, education, our work with legislation, as we're doing with you today. And then operationally, we work together to have more comprehensive results and to keep our operational costs as low as possible. One thing that's unique about the MPCA is we are governed by a citizens board. This was set up in the legislation that created the agency in 1967. It's a 9-member board, and I am the chair. The members of the board are appointed by the governor. We are the agency work goes on day to day, and most of it the board is not directly involved in. The board provides for public oversight and decision-making when controversial regulatory issues or environmental reviews come forward. An example of the board's activities are to when we look at last year, 2012, there were 12 projects that came before the board for review or approval. Prior to that, in years in 2011 and 2010, there were about 6 or 7. But as part of our agency work, there are 3,000 to 5,000 permitting actions or decisions made every year. So a very small subset come to the board. We provide the board with regular updates about our work and about the progress that we're making in our outcomes. The issues that do come before our board tend to be very complex. They're some of the more typically controversial are projects that draw in a great deal of public interest or community interest. And there were changes made in the early 1990s that removed the board from its involvement in more routine permits, and that was incorporated into the statute. Our board members serve staggered four-year terms. One of the board members must be knowledgeable of agriculture, and one is knowledgeable in the area of labor. And that's, again, statutory. Any appeal of a board decision that is made on a permit is made to the directly to the Court of Appeals, again, by statute. Sometimes the board, typically when controversial matters come before us and we have a usual 30-day review process for public comment and input, oftentimes the board, upon hearing public testimony or concern, will add additional time for public input, and that is a very helpful way for us to make sure that people have the opportunity to understand complex projects and the impacts on environmental issues that they might bring forth. We are working always to improve our board decision-making processes, and we have been considering some improvements that would establish some automatic triggers to bring projects before the board for decision, to make it more transparent to the public and to the regulated parties what types of issues are going to go before our board. We also have some challenges in receiving timely information. You understand this because of the challenges that you all face as legislators, that when people want to present to the board, we're faced often with last-minute information coming in, and not everyone being able to see that information poses some challenges. So we want to address that timeliness problem in our board processes. And then we do want to review the mandatory category thresholds for environmental review and complete those improvements which the governor has charged us to look at.
Commissioner, just for a moment, would you prefer questions as you go along on these topics or questions when you've finished?
Madam Chair, I've got about three more slides. Perhaps I should finish those and then take questions. Would that be all right?
Then we'll have questions.
Thank you. The agency operates under several federal program authorities, and just again, for those of you who have not had the chance to receive a briefing about our agency or our work, we are to the state of Minnesota what the Environmental Protection Agency is to the nation, with one exception. The Safe Drinking Water Act, which is under the EPA's purview, is administered by the Minnesota Department of Health. And so the programs you see here are driven by a variety of federal programs, including the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Superfund Law, and the Resource Conservation Recovery Act, which deals with hazardous and solid waste materials. And as I said earlier, our programs integrate a number of activities and actions that are encapsulated in these federal laws and then in the state laws that empower us to implement them, including environmental review processes, permitting processes, inspection processes, and enforcement. We are required to meet the federal standards. And for those of you who have worked with standards before, perhaps in other lines of work, consider road construction. A standard is a minimum design. In our work, standards are often well above where we currently operate, because standards are set to optimally create air, land, and water that is healthy and sustainable. And so often what we find ourselves talking to people about is the standards seem unattainable in some perspectives. But our standards are not like the standards you design a road to, which is you will not accept a standard less than this. Our standards are we're currently below these standards and we need to work to attain them. You'll see us talking about that in our air permitting programs, in our water programs, and in our solid waste programs. The federal government does audit the work that we do, and we meet with them regularly with the EPA Region 5 offices in Chicago. And for those of you who know, Minnesota is one of several states that functions within Region 5 that includes Minnesota, Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, and Ohio. North Dakota, South Dakota, are in Region 8 of EPA, and that's a region that's administered out of Denver. So oftentimes people hear stories about how we're overseen by EPA and the differences between states. We in Region 5 are, I believe, quite consistently overseen, but there are some regional differences that we observe when we look at federal program oversight. As I mentioned, one of our the hallmarks of the work in our agency is continuous improvement. I was fortunate to come to this agency after these processes had been instituted, beginning in 2003. The agency has been progressively more and more focused on systematic review, improvement, and designing more efficient and effective processes. We use continuous improvement tools, including Six Sigma and Lean, as a very structured approach for assessing our processes, gathering our customers' input, collecting and utilizing the data on our programs and the environment, analyzing current problems, and identifying ways to improve our work so that we accomplish results. To provide our best environmental protection improvement, we must constantly review and improve key processes, and the stakeholders and the public. Our stakeholders oftentimes we refer to in different groups as regulated parties and the general public and local units of government and so forth. They require us to look at new approaches, standards changing, and limited resources. Our overall goal is to eliminate waste, and I think the agency has done a very good job of this. We have an annual continuous improvement seminar in December of every year to look at projects and how they've eliminated waste in our agency, how we've streamlined processes, while at the same time maintaining environmental outcomes. What you're going to hear from our staff in the budget presentation, I just want to give you a brief overview. Our budget is built on ensuring that our decisions are based on data, scientific data, operational data, and that our programs have measurable outcomes. As I said, one of the areas that we're very concerned about is public health. Since leaving the Department of Health and coming to the agency, I was concerned about the language of the agency not including typical public health outcomes and measures. And as we know, those of you who know the history of the agency, it started because of water pollution control issues. Throughout the middle part of the century, early part of the century, there was no systematic approach to managing wastewater discharges in this state, and we had significant pollution of our state's rivers and lakes because of discharges of municipal and individual wastewater and industrial wastewater sources. So the agency grew up in a culture that was laden with human health issues, typhoid, cholera, other forms of waterborne illnesses, respiratory diseases, including asthma and cardiopulmonary disease. Those of you who grew up in the 50s and 60s know in the city you had to close your windows at night in certain neighborhoods because of the soot that would be deposited in your windowsill. Your mother couldn't hang her laundry out on the line in certain days because of particulate matter that would be on the sheets. That was my mom. And I want to make sure that we retain our focus on healthy living for all people in all of our communities. So we maintain active partnerships with local governments, and our budget will protect their operating capacity. We want to improve air quality, and we're especially focused on reducing non-point sources. As I said, we have had, those of you who have seen our dashboard presentation, you know that we've made significant progress in point source reductions in particulate matter, lead, nitrogen oxide, sulfur dioxide, and all many other constituents. Now what we're seeing, similar to what we're seeing in water, is the non-point sources, the smaller distributed sources of pollution that are contributing to particulate matter levels across the metropolitan area and other parts of the state. And our challenge is to address these non-point sources effectively. Those non-point sources of air pollution, especially in the metropolitan area, can be drivers of health risk, especially for people who are vulnerable, who are asthmatic, have type 2 diabetes, or have cardiopulmonary disease risk in their family. So it's important that we get ahead of those non-point sources of air pollution. We also want to finish some major construction activities on the state's closed landfills. Those of you who've heard the presentation before know that we have 112 closed landfills in our program. These are landfills that were unable to be addressed by local units of government, and they are now in the program. We have remediated 110 of those 112 sites. Remediated means they're now in a lined facility with groundwater and leachate collection systems and methane gas collection systems. There are two that remain in the program that are not yet remediated. One is the Flying Cloud landfill, and you'll hear about our budget proposal to begin work on the Flying Cloud landfill remediation project in this year. And Flying Cloud landfill, for those of you who don't know, is in the city of Eden Prairie. The last landfill that I would love to see accomplished in this administration is the Burnsville Burnsville Freeway landfill, which is the landfill immediately across 35W as you're crossing the Minnesota River going south. That is a landfill that will be a significant cost to remediate. We are going to maintain our focus on permitting timeliness and in improving our delivery of permits so that the public is assured that permits meet current standards and that business owners know that they have protection under the law by having these permits. One of our key challenges is to improve our service experience for our citizens and our businesses. Our databases in our agency are 17 years old. They were built on a foundation of access tables and access databases, which are all related but separate, and it is impossible for a business owner or a citizen to come into our systems and gather information about whatever they want to know about their project or about their area of the state, about our air, land, and water resources. We've got to begin making progress on fixing our database systems and improving them so that landowners, citizens, and regulated parties can work more effectively with the data that we all use. Lastly, I want to say a little bit about water quality in our state. Water quality impairments are significant in Minnesota. Many people ask, why are there so many water quality impairments? It's because we measure. It's because we look, and we're grateful for the assistance that we've received as an agency with the Clean Water Fund support. When that those legacy dollars were authorized under the constitutional amendment and then started coming into our agency, we moved from an old cycle of assessing water resources that was individually based, segment by segment, lake by lake, body of water by body of water. We're now using a watershed-based approach, which looks at the 81 major watersheds of the state to characterize water resources and their state of impairment, integrating physical, chemical, and biological characteristics into one synthesized approach to assessing those impairments. 40% of the waters we've assessed are impaired. That's a number we need to reduce. We need to protect those water resources that are not yet impaired because, as I said earlier, the least expensive form of achieving health in our personal lives and in our environment is to prevent damage from occurring in the first place. So we feel a great burden to complete our watershed assessments. We want to get those done. We're currently in year 5 of a 10-year cycle. The old method where I said we're doing lake by lake, river by river, was going to take us somewhere around 100 years to get the state properly assessed for our water quality. We need to do this. We need to finish our watershed assessments in our 10-year cycle and then return to those watersheds and monitor how the improvements are going and tell the people of Minnesota whether we're meeting standards yet or not and shine a light on our water quality issues. Why is this important to me? Because we are at the top of every national watershed in the country. Our state is not the recipient of anyone else's water. 99.2% of the water that flows out of our state fell on our state. And so it's imperative, in my view, that Minnesotans understand the responsibility that we hold to downstream states and continents and countries. You just may have heard about Lake Winnipeg and phosphorus levels that are contributing to algae growth in Lake Winnipeg and what's going to become another hypoxic zone if it If we can head that off, it's our responsibility to lead that effort, just like it is our responsibility to reduce nitrogen loading in the Minnesota River to head off hypoxia in the Gulf of Mexico. So these are some of the things you'll hear in our budget presentation, both on our base budgets as well as when we're able to present our information related to the Clean Water Fund. With that, Madam Chair, I'll answer any questions that you might have.
Well, thank you for the presentation. And just before I call on folks for questions, I just want to thank you for bringing up the public health issue. I know just from all the interaction with my constituents that is what they expect, that these are the agencies that protect them from, and what they're talking about is their health. So thank you for doing that. With that, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Stein, thanks for being here. I have a question. When you talked about the Citizens Board and some permits coming before that, the controversial ones, can you outline briefly for us what would be the triggers or the mechanisms that would bring that permit to that board?
There are several automatic triggers. There are others where the board members can request a permit to be brought before the board, and then there are times when the agency of its own volition refers a matter to the board. Oftentimes, as I said, with the 12 projects that made it before the board last year, some of those were mining, iron ore mining permits for air discharges or water discharges. There are certain categories of actions that involve variances to our standards that are required to come to the board. Those that have gone through mandatory environmental impact statements and decisions on environmental impact statements that the agency does are required to come to the board. So there are a variety of things, and then there are some discretionary, there are mandatory kind of triggers, and then there are some discretionary triggers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And also then, once the issue gets to that level, what kind of timeline are we looking at in order to be able to resolve that?
Well, our goal, Representative Fabian, Madam Chair, is to bring the matter before our board in a timely fashion. Often, as I say, the board's decision can be made at the meeting that the board hears the information. There have been times where the board has added additional time to the decision-making process to allow the company who is regulated to present additional information or the public. Typically, though, we meet once a month, and those additional time frames are generally limited to the next meeting.
Thank you. And then one last question, Madam Chair, please. Thank you. And then you talked about particulate matter in your mother's sheets and so forth, and I appreciate that. I'm concerned about some of the cost-benefit ratios that are there. The city of Thief River Falls, for example, on their standby generator that they run 60 to 80 hours a year, is being forced to pay about $300,000 to put catalytic converters and so forth on that. What I'm concerned about is with some of the rules that may come forward in the future, one size fits all. And there's a great deal of difference between, you know, the air quality in the metropolitan area, I understand that, compared to northwest Minnesota, for example. Do you have any comments on that, please?
Madam Chair, Representative Fabian, as I said, standards are standards for air we hold as standards for clean air, regardless of whether you live in Thief River Falls or Minneapolis. Often what you're hearing about as people are going through their permits and how they're going to attain those standards come through schedules to come into compliance in their permit. So we often under the EPA rules and under our state rules do have to look at availability of the best available control technologies, how affordable that is a part of that determination. And so if it is challenging from an affordability standpoint, oftentimes there's a schedule that we incorporate into our permit or an enforcement decision that gives a business owner or a permittee time to achieve that standard. That is so that we achieve the standard. And so there's often, as I say, the difference between a standard where you're going to build something and it's going to meet that standard on the day you're done is often different than how we implement standards through our permits and through our enforcement proceedings.
Thank you.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. I have two questions. One is on the Citizens Board. I'm not sure if you mentioned on where we are with any vacancies or steps in the process right now or appointments.
Madam Chair, Representative Hanson, there are three vacant positions, and there have been a number of applicants presented. My understanding is, and just like all boards and commissions in the state, applicants go through the Secretary of State's application process. We are experiencing a little dearth of work at the board. We're not having a board meeting this month, and we didn't have one last month. So we're working hard to fill those vacancies, and I believe the governor's on track to make appointments in the next few weeks to fill those vacant positions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I want to switch to a topic which is kind of timely, and that is industrial sand mining. And the counties have approached me about a problem with exploration borings not being capped or filled. And I don't know if that's in your agency or if that's a combination with you and DNR or if that's completely a local control issue. And is there a difference between the sand exploration and some of the other extracting explorations?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanson, the state well code that includes borings is administered by the Minnesota Department of Health. So the construction of the borehole is regulated. There's a code that defines how boreholes are to be constructed and then how they're to be used or eliminated. So I would refer you to the Department of Health for that question. Relative to the industrial sand and silica sand mining activities in Minnesota, there's certainly a legacy of businesses that have operated industrial sand mining. You can think of areas around Mankato and Le Sueur and Jordan and Shakopee for some of those facilities. And those have been larger, more integrated mining activities where the rock is mined and processed, and processing can be a washing and drying and sorting and all kinds of different processes. And then the shipping is typically by rail from that same facility. And so some of the more traditional silica industrial sand mining is been operating for decades in that style. What we've seen of concern to some counties lately is the proposal to do a more hub and spoke style of mining and processing of industrial sands. And of course there's a demand for industrial silica sand because of hydrologic fracking that's going on, or hydraulic fracking in western North Dakota and Texas, southern Illinois, all over the continent to obtain natural gas. So that we've gotten a lot of questions from counties as well as to how to evaluate those mining operations. Some of the mining operations that don't involve processing will not require any air emissions permits from the agency, but they will certainly require construction stormwater permits from the agency. And so we've been answering a number of questions ourselves and are very interested in supporting local governments that are trying to get their arms around a comprehensive understanding of the industry as it expands.
Thank you, Chair. One final follow-up. I'd like to focus on the groundwater appropriation for washing sand and then where the effluent goes. And if that process is in your shop or a combination with DNR, and when we've had presentations earlier about problems or challenges with groundwater quantity and taking pure groundwater or groundwater that could be used for drinking water, if that's occurring, and using that for washing silica sand, and then what happens with the effluent. I know we've got the presentation coming up, but sure. I think that's an important question.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, that one of the side benefits of having been on this tour of state agencies is that I've worked on all three of the programs. So the construction of the well to get water to wash is the DNR, or excuse me, is the Health Department's well code responsibility. The appropriation of the water from the well for use in washing is the DNR's water appropriation permit. The discharge of any water that exceeds specific thresholds, again, that's true for the DNR as well. You need to exceed a certain volume to require a permit. But the processing water and the wastewater effluent is subject to permit by the Pollution Control Agency. Our permits are aimed at, as I said, as we assess watershed water quality conditions, we use permits to make sure that discharges will not further impair a watershed's water quality. That's why we have the permit for those types of activities. So it depends on the unique facilities situation and how they're geographically and topographically situated. Many of the facilities can manage their processed water on site and have very limited periods of discharge at specific times of the year. Some of them would require a more ongoing discharge, and the standards then and the design to achieve those standards would be variable, but that's what our permits assure.
Thank you. Representative Hansen, the Department of Health receives some of the clean water money, and so they are scheduled to come before this committee fairly shortly. So if you want to have, there'll be an opportunity, I think that's a good opportunity for us to discuss it as a group. And when DNR comes before us, I think we can discuss the groundwater appropriations, because I think one of the issues there is the expectation that there's plenty of groundwater to do all the sand washing. However, that is an immense amount of water in some places where we may not have that source of water. And so one of the things I think we've got to discuss as a committee is letting people know they ought to check their water sources before they go for a permit, because they spend all the time permitting and then get stuck because there's no water. So I think we've got to have some change so people check out their water first. You have enough water to run the business that you want to run. So that's one of the things. With that, we're next at... Oh, Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Commissioner, and thank you for being here. And we do like your wide array of experiences and track record. It helps very much, and I'm always impressed by your amount of knowledge on all the different things. Thank you. I've got a couple easy ones and maybe a little harder one I can start with. Can you just give me an idea of the scope of the Burnsville landfill, the scope of the project, what are the opportunities, and what are the real tough things there?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, the Burnsville landfill is, I don't know the specific acreage of it, but it operated for decades, and it's a sizable volume of waste. It's situated adjacent to Ed Kramer's quarry, so the landfill property is immediately adjacent. If you think of, and I'm just going to visualize this for you, you're in the floodplain of the Minnesota River, all right? You're crossing the river, and it's broad floodplain, and then you have this hill that's an unnatural hill because it's a pile of garbage. And then you have a deep hole adjacent down into the limestone that's been mined for and quarried for dimensional stone and aggregate material. And so sitting adjacent to that is the river. And the unique situation in Burns at that landfill is that any kind of leachate challenges that are present are typically managed because of the Kramer quarry operation that has a deep hole that pumps water to keep the hole dry so they can operate. So we have no flow of that any leachate leaving the landfill that we know of and reaching the river. When the quarry operations cease someday, that will be a new challenge. So there's an opportunity there. If we look, the typical work on remediating a landfill is to dig a hole, put a liner in it that meets engineering standards, and then dig up the waste and put that waste in that lined landfill facility that has a leachate collection system and a methane, any kind of methane gas collection system. So there's an opportunity there, but it's a big volume of material, and they're two large parcels of land. And so the challenges are going to be to address that. How are we going to get those landowner issues resolved, and the cost of remediating is going to be significant.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner, you are just the kind of person that can take that on, because, as you know, Cramer has shown their willingness. They have a very innovative water reuse for the city of Burnsville that protected Fenn and Savage by a phenomenal amount of water that was getting dumped in the Minnesota River is now being utilized for drinking water in the South Metro through a combination of bonding and Cramer money maybe about 5-6 years ago. So I think, and you alluded to yourself, there's a deep hole already there right next to it. We could line that facility, capture the methane gas and such, and work with Cramer and the landfill owner, and I look forward to the opportunity there. That was a hard question. Then I have a couple of easy ones. What's your thoughts on wood stoves and triclosan?
Madam Chair, I might disagree with your characterization of hard and easy, Representative McNamara. By the way, on the freeway landfill, I'll take all the help I can get at achieving that solution. On wood stoves, they can be a significant source of particulate matter emissions. Wood stoves that are external to your home or your business and are heating sources are one thing. Home fires, you know, backyard recreational fires in fireplaces are all potential sources of particulate matter emissions. The agency understands that I describe our work in a variety of different ways, but we aim at improving the environment. We get there through a lot of different approaches. Many of them are voluntary. So our first approach on everything is to educate and ask people voluntarily to do the right thing to improve the environment. Then we move along to regulation. If voluntary approaches don't succeed and don't meet our goals, our shared goals, and then once we've had some degree of adoption of regulations and permitting that follow, then there's an enforcement process. I would say the vast majority of people want to operate on the voluntary end of the scale. That's what we want too. On wood stoves and on particulate matter, that's going to be our first approach, is ask people, look for incentives and tools to get voluntary action to reduce particulate matter emissions. There's a work group that's coming forward with recommendations on the question of reducing particulate matter, especially in the metropolitan area where we're at risk for non-attainment with the federal standards. Non-attainment with federal standards would be challenging for businesses because it would obligate the state to develop a plan to reduce particulate matter across the metro area. That's what goes on in Chicago, New York, California, and we want to avoid non-attainment I won't say at all costs, but it's very important that we avoid non-attainment. So the work group that we asked to look at this is coming back with information about wood smoke. On triclosan, I worked with a state epidemiologist at the Department of Health, and Dr. Ruth Linfield, and I recall her lamenting the fact that triclosan was added to soaps and cleansers really as a device to improve marketing and sales of soaps. Soap is soap. Vigorous hand washing and drying of your hands will eliminate bacteria from your skin, but the fact that triclosan is an antibacterial agent is helped certain manufacturers market their products. What concerns me as I look at it is, and this is coming from our state epidemiologist, is the is the increasing level of bacterial resistance that we're seeing, both in hospital settings and in our world. So triclosan is a concern from a public health standpoint. Then when I read the recent article related to triclosan degrades in the environment, or it mobilizes in the environment in water to form dioxin, I have a lot of questions. I'd like to understand it better, and I'd like to hear more, and I've asked the university professor that did the research to get a copy of his information and his research for me.
Well,
excuse me for
go
just
ahead.
A second. We did get those research papers. I believe they're up front. We'd put them in people's packets, but I think they've probably been recycled by now. But we have some. There are some up front, so please take one.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Representative McNamara suggested that we have Dr. Arnold visit with us, and we will do that. So just.
Well, and thank you, Madam Chair, and I believe you also sent it to us electronically, so we have gotten that. You were right, Commissioner. I was being facetious in the easy and hard ones, and I've got one more. One, I noticed in the audience today you've attracted, I think, every business interest lobbyist here and almost none of the environmental lobbyists. So I'm just curious on the product stewardship, a really bold initiative. Have you worked with both sides on that issue, and are they aware of your efforts here, and what's the possibility of us getting consensus from all the different groups to be supportive or be against or whatever's going to happen?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, you'll hear more from Assistant Commissioner Kadelka about that in our presentation, but we have worked on our product stewardship proposals for carpeting, for paint, and for primary batteries. We worked with the industry. And we believe that we have nearly achieved agreement. I will never say for sure until the conversation ends, but it's our belief that we've worked with the industry very actively and that they are in support of these ideas. Product stewardship, for those of you who've not looked into that law or that concept, is about eliminating potentially harmful materials from our waste stream and making wiser uses of them, or managing them in a way that's more sustainable for the environment. We do that right now with the electronics. Electronic devices do not go to landfills. They're not supposed to go to landfills. They're supposed to be collected through a product stewardship plan that the manufacturers and distributors mutually implement. We're looking at the same kind of a process for paint and for primary batteries and for carpeting, which are some of the more problematic solid waste materials in our experience with landfill owners and operators and local units of government around the state.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Another easy one here, Commissioner. Last night in the governor's State of the State message, he talked about lowering the time frame for permitting from 150 down to 90 days. That's a 60% reduction. How realistic is that, and what is your agency doing to attempt to meet that timeline?
As I said, Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, we do use continuous improvement tools. So part of the good news is we have improved our permit application receiving and processing systems across the agency, so that we can make a timely determination of permitting completeness. And I know there are a number of people from representing businesses that were concerned that we were going to, when we set these goals for timeliness, that we were going to end up having to return permit applications as incomplete in order to make our numbers look good. Last year, the numbers of permits returned as incomplete were less than 5%. So the good news is that we're able to meet that incoming threshold screen of review and then process. Right now, about on average, all permits for the agency, about 86% of permits are getting out the door within 150 days. Of our construction-related permits, our priority permits, we're at 97% out the door in 150 days. So the 90-day goal that the governor has set and that we concur with is to look at those projects that are getting done that do not require extensive public comment periods or reviews, and there are the more straightforward processes where we know we can focus and do a better job than 150 days. And as a manager, when your agency takes the goal that the governor set and does a good job of maintaining it, it's time to look at tightening that goal. And that's what we've discussed with the governor, and we support managing it. We're not going to be able to meet 90 days for all categories of permits in the agency, and that's not what we've discussed with the governor. We've discussed an approach where the permits that we can parse out that will meet a more straightforward review process will have a 90-day goal for those. We will never have a permit out the door for 150 days on a complicated project like a waste-to-energy burner, a facility that expands and or establishes. We'll never have meet that 150 days for complex mining projects, for example. But the goal is important, because when you set the goal, our staff are good at measuring their progress toward it, and we've been very pleased with the outcome. We are doing that, and I might say to those who might be concerned, without reducing the quality of our permitting or the ability to meet standards. And so that's important as well.
Just a quick follow-up. You mentioned the completed application. Is there a point person that a business or a person can contact that they know of to know if that application is complete, and so that kind of logjam can be worked over smoothly?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, yes. The agency has an incoming permit review screening process, and if there is a question about a permit application, there will be a phone call made. We always encourage permit applicants to come in and have a pre-application meeting with our staff, because that's where they're going to know what we consider to be the essential components of a permit application, and they can do their best job before they've even applied at understanding what it is they're going to be responsible for submitting. And as I said, 95% of the applicants are doing well at that.
Thank you. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for being with us today. First, I'd like to ask a little bit more about the Citizens Board. Can you give me an estimate of how much time is added to the process if an application does go before the Citizens Board?
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, I would venture to say it's a 30 to 90 day, depending upon the complexity of a project, additional time frame. That often is within the 150 days, though, but it is important to note that we ask our board members to review the materials, which are extensive, and we ask them to become aware of the issues. And so the time that the board spends reviewing it is often on, as I said, the most complex kinds of projects that we face.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there any potential for the Citizens Board process to be used to delay projects that would be scientifically appropriate for approval?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson, I think people come before the board and issues come before the board with many different perspectives. Yes, it's possible that people would try to ask the board to look at issues that are red herrings or unrelated, but I have not experienced a significant concern about that in my time at the agency. I have been reasonably impressed by the citizens and the organizations that come before the board and businesses that put information before us. There is a risk, though, that, you know, by the volume of questions that get asked, in responding to their questions, you are adding time. That's certainly true. But I've been more impressed by the extensive discussion that occurs when people bring questions before the board or ask questions about a project, and the board members themselves want to understand the project more completely. I guess my career in government leads me to believe that the more participation, the better the outcome. That's been my experience, and I think we do have a challenge, as I said earlier, in people bringing information that they want to give to the board on the day of the meeting. That's a challenge, because the board members haven't had a chance to review it. the rest of the people in the audience don't know what's being discussed, and that's a challenge for us. So we want to do something to streamline and make clear what citizens or companies are required to do. We've had that from both, from people trying to slow down the process to people trying to convince us that they've got the right argument for their project. And I don't think it's fair to people. I just don't think it's a good way to administer a board when everyone else can't see the information at the same time and evaluate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Along these same lines, could you just briefly discuss the impact of litigation on the agency's actions and the impact of threatened litigation?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, threatened litigation is... I've been threatened with litigation my entire career, and I think it's been the same all along. We do our work to uphold the standards and enforce the laws of the state. If people want to litigate, that's their right. We do not consider the threat of litigation to be a significant challenge for us, because our goal in administering the law and the rules of our programs is to satisfy them. And if people just disagree with our conclusion, that's their purview. So we know there are threats and people who are concerned about our actions who might take legal action, but I don't know. I've had that my whole career, and it's never really daunted me about making a decision. The more important thing is to make the decision, because the threat of anything is more easily resolved when you're making the decision and people can move on to the next step. Secondly, the litigation that comes before the agency, we do have a number of lawsuits underway and pending in the agency at any given time. When it comes to our enforcement proceedings, that often can lead to legal challenges. But we work to reduce the cost of litigation. We have successfully enforced our permits and our violations of our regulations with fairly effective tools inside our agency. So I'm in terms of my travels around state government, the profile that this agency has in terms of litigation is pretty normal for all the regulatory work that I've done.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one more question in a different area. You mentioned the efforts where continuing to go through the 10-year cycle of watersheds and analysis and working with that process with the 81 major watersheds. It comes to mind that these watersheds are approximately the same size all across the state, but they vary greatly in complexity. Is there any talk within the agency about adjusting the size of those watersheds based on the complexity of the issues that are involved, or changing the time frame perhaps because of complexity?
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, the complexity is sort of a function of the natural and artificial hydrography, or the hydrologic infrastructure of a watershed. You know, so some of them are very stable. I would say that's your complexity. If I were to characterize it, some watersheds are very stable because they haven't been highly modified. Others are significantly unstable because they have been significantly modified. The 81 watershed discussion I was present for in my work as a hydrologist at DNR, and it was a significantly challenging level of agreement to achieve about what scale. I'd be very, and I think the agency prior to my arrival set some TMDL work in place, some water quality assessment work for Lake Pepin, for example, in the southern Mississippi, the reach of the Mississippi River, and those basin scales are too large to effectively implement restoration protection strategies, and we've learned that lesson. That's why we've gone to this smaller watershed scale approach, and we think it's far more sustainable and understandable to citizens. Now, reprioritizing our work, yeah, we're always open to that. We're always open to whether it would achieve a more beneficial outcome in terms of environment and water quality. I am a believer, though, that we should complete the watershed assessment first cycle. We should make it to every one of the 81 watersheds and get those assessments completed. We're using some great new tools to show where the problems arise in a watershed, what kinds of issues are driving water quality impairments, and where they come from. And we really want to get on to keeping that momentum moving forward.
Thank you.
Just one final comment, Madam Chair. I would agree with you that we should finish the 10-year cycle, but I think we should also be thinking about preparing how we're going to approach the next 10 years. Thank you.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning, Commissioner. Listening to the discussion about the silica mining and all the issues related to that, I was looking at the AIR program budget handout you gave. And you know, there's a lot of discussion in the mass media about a really revolutionary process that's going on here, not just in North Dakota with the oil fields there with fracking, but also in, you know, states like Pennsylvania and New York and all over in the discussion that the United States has maybe 100 years of natural gas reserves, and that this is going to be a revolutionary change for us, and actually the United States could end up being a net exporter of energy. I was looking on page 3 here, and the chart having to do with mercury emissions and the projections that are listed 2005, 2008, 2018. And I'm just wondering whether or not this process of introducing natural gas to replace coal production, and I see that coal production is a very large part of, or the burning, you know, energy production from coal is a large proportion of mercury emissions, whether or not we will see an escalation in the use of natural gas to replace oil or replace coal. I think I just read that one plant in Minnesota is converting to natural gas from coal, and we had a few years ago a big debate about a coal burning plant being built in northern Minnesota and the concerns there on the fragile ecosystem. And so is your agency involved in any of that to encourage the conversion from coal to natural gas, or are these projections very recent, or do you think there may be a speed up in the process that you will be maybe reevaluating these goals for 2018-2025?
Madam Chair and Representative Benson, the agency is encouraged by conversion of coal-fired power plants to natural gas. It definitely reduces mercury emissions and other air pollution sources. We coordinate the state's energy policy is not our policy to implement. Our job is to assure attainment with national air ambient air quality standards and the air standards that we enforce in our permits. That is an important dimension of improving our air quality, is to reduce the sources of mercury emission. We've had a significant mercury emission reduction in recent years, thanks to policy here at the legislature, as well as permitting actions of our agency, and then the improvement work that utilities have implemented to reduce their own sources of mercury. Xcel has converted the Highbridge plant and the Riverside plant from coal fire to natural gas, and those are important emission reduction efforts. So we want to see those continue. And I know that the governor is interested in further improving air quality through all sorts of actions that would reduce sources of air pollution. So it is important to our agency. We work closely with the Department of Commerce and their Division of Energy Resources and the Public Utilities Commission in our permitting approaches.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're finished.
Yes, ma'am.
Representative, we have two more questions for you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. You mentioned something about in this cycle, you had three things that you test for water quality. One of them was biological.
Yep.
Could you explain the biological things that you're looking for?
Bugs all the way up to fish, into the and the macroinvertebrates and the microorganisms that live in the water column and in an aquatic system. So when we talk about a biological system of, in an aquatic setting, we're talking about the biology, the ecology, the aquatic ecology of that stream. So it's the food chain ranging from the wading birds that eat the minnows, the you know, macroinvertebrates, microinvertebrates, the microorganisms that live in the sediments. And when our staff go out and do assessments for water quality, working with the Department of Natural Resources, Fisheries, and Ecological Resources staff, we have an approach to gather biological samples. So our folks are out there grabbing the samples of the bugs and trying to assess the community in that aquatic ecosystem so we can characterize it in our watershed assessment.
Thank you. Just a quick follow-up. Is that information then shared with the aquatic invasive species people, for instance, if they need access to it? So what you're saying then is in these first 5 years now, there is a baseline of data for all of the micro species and all the way up the food chain in the 5 years that you've sampled.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, that's correct. And we also look at chemical characteristics of the water column, its conductivity, its pH, a lot of other, and then nutrients, sediment, and then just the physical character of the of a stream, for example. Are the banks stable? Are the banks eroding? We get specific data on that water body so that we can come back in our next 10-year cycle and evaluate against what we learned the first time. So the science of it is to integrate all of those physical, chemical, and biological factors into a report of the condition of that water body, and then share that information in a report, which we've done. So we have reports that give all that information both to our citizens, to our sister agencies, and the EPA. And then our cycle, our 10-year cycle, means we'll be back. We won't have to replicate that work in the next 10-year cycle. We'll just be monitoring that system to look for the changes that have occurred. So the second 10-year cycle won't be a repeat of the first 10-year cycle, because some of that work was to get the hydrology sorted out, the physical character of the body of water will you know have already been defined. The second 10-year cycle will just be to monitor the condition and see how things have improved or degraded or stayed the same.
Just a quick follow-up. For instance, then, if you are, let's take Mille Lacs Lake, which is a huge body of water that's struggling. If you had a baseline data of, say, 3 or 4 years ago, would you not check that again quicker before the 7 or 10 years that it would take to get back to that place on it, knowing that it's a body of water in trouble?
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, if it's a body of water in trouble yet, we need to think cautiously about what that means. The fishery resource in that body of water is not reproducing, and that's something that DNR looks at annually. So DNR has an annual fishery survey of a lake. Like Mille Lacs, they've got significant data on the fishery population. So there are subcomponents of the biological system that DNR is evaluating on a more frequent basis. Our job is more to understand the entire system, and when those conditions are probably not necessarily the conditions that might drive the fishery resource on Lake Mille Lacs. But we do work with DNR and help them to, if they see that there's a biological indicator that needs further work, then we would be asked to assist them, or they would probably be doing the work themselves to more quickly figure that system out. So it depends on what the questions are. Our job, again, is when we look at the physical, chemical, biological characteristic of Lake Mille Lacs, we do share all of that data with the DNR, and the DNR then follows on with their annual fishery surveys and qualitative assessments to look for additional information they might need.
Thank you. Thank you, ma'am.
Just as a follow-up question to Representative Erickson, as you're looking at the fish, just are they there and right. Do they have a smile on their face, are you looking specifically at their reproductive system? And I ask that because there's so much science coming in saying that endocrine disruptors are changing their reproductive system. So if we're not checking that now as baseline, then we may be missing something big. Yep. We may not be, right. But it does seem to me we ought to be checking it just for the reasons he asked. Is that part of the protocol now?
Madam Chair, I don't know. I would ask our staff when they come forward with our water budget, our watershed assessment budget information, if you wouldn't mind to ask that question. We can certainly get the committee information, but I do agree some of these what some might say subtle or less detectable changes in organisms are of concern to us, that they I know from my work at the Department of Health on drinking water risk assessment and setting limits for contaminants in drinking water, part of what we're learning about human development and human reproduction is that very subtle, small amounts timed at just the wrong time of development can have a significant consequence on the outcome of a developing fetus. And of human growth and in adolescent years. So there are a growing body of scientists who are concerned and are publishing scientific information that are going to help us do better at understanding that. But I would agree that we need to look carefully at that question and see if our assessments are robust in that area.
Thank you. Well, Representative Fabian had the last question, but he's not here. So with that, we thank you for your presentation. And, oh, I'm sorry, I missed one. My peripheral vision on this side is not as good as it should be. Representative Falk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess just to kind of add on Representative Erickson's question about what you sample for biological, does that also include bacterial or viral organisms?
Madam Chair, Representative Falk, bacterial, yes. Virology, I'll have to defer to the staff on that one. So when the staff present, hopefully they can give you a more complete description of what a typical assessment protocol includes.
Thank you.
Thanks once again for coming and for staying for a good back and forth with question and answer. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And next we will have up, I believe, the Assistant Commissioner, Kadelka, and the CFO, Lyle Mueller.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair and Committee members. For the record, my name is Kirk Kadelka, and I'm with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I'm real quick going to turn this over to my colleague, Mueller. We're going to talk just briefly here about overall trends of the agency, budget and other areas, give you a better description of where our funding comes from and where it goes, and then later into the presentation, break down to our five budget areas: air, land, water, cross-media services and environmental assistance, and administrative support. And we'll take those as chunks at another date, but right now, turn it over to my colleague.
Madam Chair, my name is Lyle Mueller. I'm the finance manager for the MPCA. So what we're going to do today is provide a few slides that give you some context and some background. The first slide gives you a 10-year view, a 10-year history of what our funding has been. Actual numbers through fiscal 12, as well as obviously budget in fiscal 13, and then our budget plan for 14 and 15. There are a couple items on that particular chart that I want to draw to your attention. first of all, the general fund. As a state agency, our percentage of general funding has fallen over this 10-year period. You can see that in three particular fiscal years, 7, 8, and 9, that immediately follows the passage of the Clean Legacy Act, and that in those years we were funded to do a lot of the tasks related to the Clean or the Legacy Act from the general fund. Starting in fiscal 10, that was the transition to the Clean Water Fund, and so you see that as kind of that new orange color that shows up for the first time in fiscal 10, and then continues right through 15. So, believe it or not, we are going into years 5 and 6 already with that new funding source. But other things, just to kind of provide perspective, you can see that a number of our other funding sources have been relatively stable over that period of time. For example, our federal funding on a graph like this has been stable. Our funding through the Environmental Fund, perhaps if you measured that very precisely, has tended upwards, but overall has been stable. When you look at our FTE numbers over that same period of time, again, these correspond to significant changes in funding and activities that we've seen over this time frame. For example, as the step ups in FTE numbers, staffing numbers, as you look back at fiscal years 7, 8, and 9, reflect the ramp up of the Clean Water Legacy work. Also in that time frame, particularly in 8 and 9, there were initiatives related to the mining ethanol or the economic sector work that we were funded to do in that time frame. Over the years, let's say fiscal 9 through 11, essentially staffing was stable. But remember, across all of state government, there was a hiring chill, and so as vacancies occurred, they were filled less frequently. And through fiscal 12, what we're reporting on is the number of staff hours that were actually paid. And then the last 3 years reflect, more planning estimates, and so there is that difference when you consider actual versus budget. Fiscal 12 is an interesting year from a staffing standpoint that reflects a number of things going on, kind of as to why we would have taken that kind of a step down. First of all, our agency participated in an early retirement incentive, and 21. For the most part, senior staffers would have left the agency under that particular effort. In fiscal 12, we also had the state shutdown, and as I said, reflecting actual hours paid, so you have 900 plus employees in the agency being paid for 15 fewer work days, and that ripples through to that kind of an effect on the chart. If you look at fiscal 13, that kind of reflects kind of back up to kind of our current and what I would consider our more normal staffing pattern. The interesting step down in 14 and 15 reflects the fact that in those two fiscal years, you will see the full implementation of the transition to minute services, where IT staff will now be reporting separately and individually through that state agency. So they will no longer be, we have roughly 70 IT positions that will be associated with MINUTE and no longer reflected in our budget or our FTE numbers. Maybe I should back up. The funding will flow through our agency as a interagency contract, but you will not see the FTE numbers reported through our budget. One of the next things that we're going to do is, while I brought up on the screen our budget picture for the biennium, and this is based on our expenditure budget, we're going to take a minute to focus on the two parts of the pie, the two funds, the environmental fund in green and the remediation fund in the violet color, and just talk a little more about the funding, the combination of receipts and transfers that go into those two funds, so that we build an understanding of what makes up those funds. We're going to pass on, because I'm assuming you already have an understanding of the general fund, clean water fund, where that comes from. So that's why the focus will only be on those two funds. First, the environmental fund.
Before we go on, we are going to take questions as we go on this one. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question, sir, on the staffing issue in 2012. Other than the shutdown, so that affected that, when there were incentives for early retirement, has the agency or does the agency plan to replace those positions, or are those permanent reductions in staffing?
Madam Chair, Representative, it really was a combination, considering position by position, whether those positions were cut or eliminated permanently or not. For example, one of our positions, one of the individuals who left during the early retirement incentive was our deputy. Clearly, the understanding right from the get-go was that is a position that would be and has been refilled. Other positions were considered on a case-by-case basis, and over a period of time, if we had a senior staffer that left with a particular set of skills, that position may have been filled in a different way in a different part of the organization. So it really is hard to make a sweeping statement as to whether all those positions were held or not. Remember that one of the primary drivers behind the early retirement incentive was you're talking about not just skills, but also higher paid employees. And this was approached as a fiscal opportunity to make different decisions and what have you.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I guess what I want to know is whether or not the reductions in certain of these staff positions was made purely because of budgetary restraints, or whether your agency has positions that should be filled, but you simply don't have the support in the budget to do it. Are there needs for certain kinds of expertise which the department needs, but it's in abeyance because of reductions in budgetary support from the legislature? I guess that's what I'm wondering.
Madam Chair, Representative, you will hear throughout our presentation our discussion about our need and desire to increase staffing in certain levels, and so that will be part of our presentation as we go. To kind of reflect back as to where we were back at the end of fiscal 11 and going into fiscal 12. At that point in time, state agencies were still coming out of a hiring freeze. We were at quite a different fiscal picture at that point in time. We felt we were facing fiscal pressures. To answer that question, as we offered that early retirement incentive, there was a strong motivation to generate budget savings. Yes. That has, however, since moderated.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Also along the lines of staffing, I just want to make sure I got this clear. The drop that we see in 14-15 is because IT employees will no longer be part of your record here?
Madam Chair, Representative, that is correct. The establishment of Minute, while it was effective earlier in this biennium, to a certain extent, it has been a step-by-step transition process. So as we're reporting on our FTEs in fiscal 13, our current fiscal year, we are still reflecting the 70 IT staff that have been working with our agency. But as you know, Minute is a separate state agency, and starting in 14 and 15, their FTE will be counted and reflected in a separate state agency budget.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so going back then, would that 70 number have been one that has been increasing since 2006, I would assume, if you tried to break out those IT employees in prior years?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't have that breakdown off the top of my head. I would venture yes, but we can certainly provide that.
Just one more quick question regarding staffing. Do you have a breakdown of how many of your staff people are in the metro area versus in your outstate offices?
Could you repeat that question? I just didn't hear it.
How many staff members are in the metro office versus outstate offices?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, we do. We can get that number. I don't have it with me. Right.
Thank you. I'd appreciate seeing that. Thanks.
Representative Kahn?
Yes, there's I think it's the state of Washington has just proposed a tax on, I don't know if they proposed it or enacted it, but a tax on any substance with hazardous materials in it, an extra tax to then be put into environmental remediation. Is that anything you've been thinking about or following?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm not aware of that, no. Okay, the Environmental Fund, talking about the source of receipts to the Environmental Fund. The Environmental Fund is, in fact, made up entirely of the solid waste tax, which kind of falls in that separate category, as categorized as a tax. Everything else is categorized as a fee. And you can see the six major breakdowns. To us and this particular fund, the solid waste tax is a vital component of revenues into the fund. Second largest category, the regulated party fees. Third category, the motor vehicle transfer fee. This is similar to a transaction fee, or perhaps almost like a sales tax fee on the transfer of vehicle ownerships. The Metro Landfill Abatement Fee is an example of a dedicated fee, meaning it comes into the fund and remains segregated. It can only be used for a particular purpose. The enforcement penalties, which we've separated just because there's been considerable interest in that particular receipt item, you can see. And 100% of enforcement penalties come into the fund and are available for multiple purposes. And then other receipts, very minor. Moving to the...
Before you move, solid waste tax is so big. I think it deserves some more explanation of where that comes from. I mean, we don't perhaps just to bring something, maybe because we are running a little bit over time, next time, starting with that, because the solid waste tax is so large, I think we do need to understand exactly the sources of that and how it comes into this pot. Would that be okay?
Madam Chair, are you thinking going down to the level of detail, understanding the different rates and fees within the tax?
I think people should just have, this is 56% of the budget. So it would be good to have just a little bit of explanation. We don't have to have a book, but a bit of an explanation for where this money comes from. I think we need to know it by region a little bit and by what taxes are in this, a list of taxes and where they come from. Is that helpful for members?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to see the same sort of information regarding the fee income.
That would be fine. I think that they've got that later on. If it's not later on, let's incorporate it as appropriate. And I think we're going to see that as we do clean air permits and water permits. That's my understanding. So we will make sure that is. Comes. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to another thing that I would like to see is on one of the slides they talked about how the agency has eliminated waste within the agency, I'll say bureaucratic waste. I'm not exactly sure. I'm putting words in the commissioner's mouth. And still maintaining quality. I'd like to see some sort of report on what types of changes. Where's the waste that they've gotten rid of? Okay. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes. Well,
thank you.
Members, we are, I adjourn this meeting. It's to adjourn it for, we will have the Pollution Control Agency before us next Tuesday during our morning hour and as long into the evening as people have questions. So that is our time. I expect we will finish up the Pollution Control Agency on Tuesday. I see no other questions, and with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.